Okay, can you hear me? We're looking at the end of chapter 3 of Mark and the start of chapter 4. So we were slightly out of sequence, and the end of Mark 3, Ben already did, so there's a bit of overlap and we're out of sequence. Other than that, we're going through it in a fairly straightforward fashion. Yeah, I'm splitting the passage into four. We'll have a little chat at the end, but well, see how things go, really. So we're going to look at Mark 3, verse 31 to 35. Then Jesus' mother and brothers arrived. Standing outside, they sent someone in to call him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, "Your mother and brothers are outside looking for you." "Who are my mother and my brothers?" he asked. Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother." Okay, so that's the first passage. And we read about how Jesus' mother and brothers have come to see him. Not in the best circumstances, because they think he's gone mad. They think he's some kind of religious nutter and he's a fanatic and they want to save him from himself. We've got a very similar passage in Mark 3, verse 21. And we read in other passages, for example, John 7, verse 5, that even his own brothers just didn't believe in him. And they've gone to some effort here. They probably travelled about 30 miles from Nazareth to Capernaum just to do this. And you can imagine the conversation that's going in Mary's head as she's coming along. She's got her little boy Jesus. "Yeah, I know he's the Son of God. But, you know, he's taking this religious bit a bit too far. You know, all things in moderation and all that." And it might come as a bit of a surprise to us that Mary doubted, because she didn't accept her son. And this is something we don't really think about. Look at a different scenario. At Calvary, the disciples thought Jesus' mission had failed. They didn't understand the resurrection. They thought Jesus was possibly speaking cryptically. After all, he was speaking a lot of parables and picture language, things like that. And Thomas said, "I'll believe it when I see it." So what adjective is usually used by Christians to refer to Thomas? Doubting Thomas. But with Mary, I would say Mary had even less cause to doubt. She'd seen an angel promising the divine birth, had visits from the shepherds and the magi. She'd seen him turn water into wine. She'd seen of or heard of the miracles. She'd seen him face the religious leaders. And now this reaction. And you never really hear here within Christian circles her being referred to as doubting Mary, do you? Doubting Thomas. You don't have doubt. Why? What's the difference? You hear Mary referred to as Holy Mary, Mother of God, full of grace in certain areas of Christendom. What's the difference? So Jesus is told that his mother and brothers are here. And he responds by saying that those around him are really his mother and brothers. Because he declares, whoever does God's will, or my Father in heaven's will, as it's recorded in Luke, is his brother, sister and mother. So this is how things stood. Jesus was more than Mary's relative son, more than a carpenter. He was God's means of salvation. And it just goes to show how heavenly ties were much more important than earthly ones, which is a fairly radical thing for this society. His physical family were not considering the will of God. And we often have a lot more in common with our spiritual family than our earthly one. Often they're a lot more supportive, a lot more reliable. Appreciate a lot of instances and a lot of overlap in terms of spiritual family and earthly family. But I think this is a good point to say, just expressing thanks to all the people who've given Sue lifts or offered to give Sue lifts for the hospital. Just a typical example. She's doing very well, by the way, a bit tired for tonight. So we've got this passage about Jesus' family. Then we move on to the parable of the four soils. Or do we? I'm just about to go for my zapper. Do we move on to the parable of the four soils? Because if you read Matthew or Mark, it follows this family incident. But in Luke, it precedes it. Ah, bit of a problem. How can we trust a Bible which is full of such obvious contradictions. There's variations in what Jesus said and even the order he did things. And how can we trust a Bible that's so erratic? And that's before we think about how it clashes with science, how it clashes with social theory. The Gospels were written to record the message of Jesus. And they were written to different audiences, and they have a different structure, and the subject matter is arranged differently. So that it's not laid out the same way. But we're okay with doing that another way. It'll work. I can see potential TradeWaste customers. I can see a man in a suit in the solicitors. I can see an Asian man selling kebabs with very limited English. I can see some naive lady who's just opened a cake shop and has just found out that she produces rubbish and it doesn't disappear by magic. My pitch is going to vary enormously depending on which of those people I'm speaking to. You know, what's important to them, how it's related to them, what they want, convenience, price, are they after recycling? So the conversations can be completely different, but ultimately it's the same overall message. It's just presented completely differently. And it's the same with this. It's the same message, but it's expressed in different terms. And we said about clashing with scientific and social theory. Well, who cares anyway? They're clashing with themselves anyway. So it's thought that Matthew and Mark Gospels are most likely to be chronological here. So what's happening here? Jesus is moving with this inside discussion because Jesus' parents, Mary and the brothers, had to go inside to what is effectively open-air evangelism. So we're at the inland sea of Tiberias. There is no tide, so there is no ebb and flow to disturb the hearers. And we read a chapter ago that Jesus got into a boat to preach. It's nice scenery. There are good acoustics. I don't know who went on the march on Good Friday in Bognor. A few people did. And I don't even remember that there was the speaker with a, not megaphone, what do you call it, the microphone. And he was sort of surrounded by people. And of course, he was talking. And you heard, you only heard the bits when he was facing, this is not the situation. It's not, I've got PA today, I'm all right. Can you all hear me, by the way? So we assume the hearers heard what Jesus is saying. But what does he say? Let's look at Mark 4. We'll start up with verses 1 to 8. I'll try and keep out of people's way again. Again, Jesus began to teach by the lake. The crowd that gathered around him was so large that he got into a boat and sat in it out on the lake, while other people were alongside the shore at the water's edge. He taught them many things by parables, and in his teaching said, "Listen, a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places, where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched, and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants, so that they did not bear grain. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up, grew, and produced a crop, some multiplying 30, some 60, some 100 times." So Jesus tells the parable that we know, the parable of the four soils. And I don't know whether, obviously, we don't have every word he said. There's no indication here he's actually saying that it is a parable. He doesn't say, "And now for today's parable." He seems to go straight into it. So are the hearers supposed to be taking it literally? And in any event, it's more of an allegory than a parable, because it's an illustration which has more than one main point. So the farmer's sowing seed. It's a very familiar concept to the hearers in what was a very agricultural society. Maybe less so in this day and age, unless you just happen to be an amateur Alan Titchmarsh here. But I mean, that's, I don't know what would be the most appropriate. What would we have a parable on? The parable of the four emails? The story seems fairly simple. A farmer goes and sows seed in various places, some on the path, some on rocky places, some among thorns, some on good soil. He has varying levels of success in each instance, pretty much as you would expect. Come on, tell us something we don't know, Jesus.
Is that it?
And the story seems to end there. I mean, is it just a discourse on growing plants? Is it like a first century version of Gardener's Question Time? Or, I don't know. We then get into this conversation about how to understand this and other parables. Next bit. Mark chapter 4, verses 9 to 13. Then Jesus said, "Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear." When he was alone, the 12 and the others around him asked him about the parables. He told them, "The secret of the kingdom of God has been given to you, but to those on the outside, everything is said in parables, so that they may be ever seeing but never perceiving, ever hearing but never understanding. Otherwise they might turn and be forgiven." Then Jesus said to them, "Don't you understand this parable? How then will you understand any parable?" That, I think, is a very confusing passage. Why is Jesus speaking in a way that is very difficult to understand? Why have you got a spiritual discourse that a lot of people are going to be bewildered by? I mean, to be fair, I've heard a lot of sermons like that. But Jesus says, "He who has ears, let him hear." In the Greek, it's in the present imperative sense. It is literally meaning, hear and make sure you accurately interpret what you've heard. So are we actually good at listening? I mean, my wife says I never listen to a word she says. Or something like that anyway. So we read that the 12 specifically ask him. You know, they say, what does this mean? We don't understand. In Mark, it says the 12 and the others. Matthew and Luke just mention the disciples. So we'll assume a proportion, we don't know how big, a proportion of his hearers want to dig deeper. So Jesus talks about how the secrets of the kingdom have been given, but to those outside, they're hidden. We've got this marvellous interplay of grace and works here, because God is revealing mysteries if we are willing to look. And he paraphrases Isaiah 6, verse 9 to 10, but he actually emphasises the negative perspective. He seems to emphasise those not prepared to look won't see, because God is revealing mysteries. I mean, the New Testament talks about the mystery of the church waiting to be revealed. Ephesians 3, verse 23, if you want to look at it later. So Jesus is here revealing mysteries, and the understanding is all of divine revelation. And that's the way of salvation. And the more you think about it, the more complex it gets. Romans 10, verse 13 says, "Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." Paul wrote that. The same Paul, which is curiously a verse we had yesterday, says he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. Hold on a minute, let me get my head around this. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved, but he's chosen us before we were born to be holy, and he's chosen us, but we've got to call on the name of the Lord who's all, yeah, okay. That apparent paradox is our salvation and our faith, and if we try and work that one out, I think we just get a headache, really. We just accept that by faith. And often we seem to sort of think that we don't understand God. We use sort of cliches that God moves in mysterious ways. In essence, we're not actually supposed to understand God. Isaiah 55, verse 9, "As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So then Jesus asks a rhetorical question. If you don't understand this one, how are you going to understand any parable? Come on, chaps. This is an easy one. Without getting this one, you don't stand a chance. But conversely, once you get this one, you can progress to the others. It's a bit like driving a car. We start off with unconscious incompetence. A baby cannot drive a car. But a baby doesn't actually know that they can't drive a car. It's unconscious incompetence. Then in our late teens or 20s, we start having driving lessons. And then we find out we can't drive. It's so confusing. There's all these buttons all over the place, and we know we're supposed to do something and we can't do it. It's conscious incompetence. We know we can't do it. Then we sort of get the hang of it. We're aware of mirror signal maneuver, gears, you've got indicators, and but you're so conscious of doing it. You're conscious, right, I'm going to slow down, I'm going to go down the gears, I'm going to brake. So it's conscious competence. You can do it, but you have to sort of think about it and work it through. Then, when you're much older, when you're, say, in your 50s, you get so used to it, you drive without thinking it through because it becomes second nature. So it's unconscious competence. It's the same here. It's so much easier. You learn God's language and then you find the communication just so second nature in lots of ways. So then Jesus explains this parable. And it's more than face value. It's not merely a how you grow plants. He says, the farmer sows the word. Some people like the seed along the path. When the word is sown, as soon as they hear it, Satan comes and takes away the word that was sown in them. Others, like the seed sown on rocky places, hear the word and at once receive it with joy. But since they have no root, they last only a short time. When trouble or persecution comes, because of the word, they quickly fall away. Still others, like seeds sown among thorns, hear the words, but the worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth, the desires for other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. Others, like seeds sown on good soil, hear the word, accept it, and produce a crop. Some 30, some 60, some 100 times what was sown. Yeah, so Jesus explains the parable. It's more than at face value. Jesus elaborates, it does have a spiritual dimension. He wasn't saying it for the sake of it. So the farmer goes and sows the seed. And there's various details in various gospels. And Jesus, Matthew says even, the one who sows the seed is the Son of Man. And the spiritual seed is the message of salvation. Luke described it as the word of God. So the seed is scattered. It's the same seed. Wherever the seed is being scattered, it is the same seed. Some falls on the path. It's not going to get anywhere. The word goes out. Satan, the evil one in Matthew, takes it away. The hearer has completely rejected it. He has no interest. His heart is closed. He doesn't want to know. He may be openly hostile. He may be ridiculing religious belief. Maybe one of these people wants to ban prayer outside abortion clinics. He wants to ban anything that's at odds with liberal morality or ethics. Have you heard the US state of Utah wants to ban the Bible in state schools because of its vulgarity and violence? To be fair, the US state of Utah is a very mixed up state. Or he may be quite religious. He might be quite happy as he is. Not necessarily openly practicing alternative faith. Maybe part of Christendom, nominally Christian, but never actually having that relationship with Jesus, still on the path. The second type is sown on rocky places. Someone who initially receives it with joy, but it doesn't last. Trouble or persecution have come, and it soon falls away. The third type is sown among thorns. Here you've got the desire for wealth and material things, which is choking him spiritually, making him unfruitful. One foot in the church, one foot in the world. And the fourth type is sown in good soil. They hear the word, they accept it, they produce a crop, which is the ideal sowing in both natural and spiritual terms. So that's the explanation. I think it answers some questions and leaves some others unanswered. So if these questions are unanswered, I think I better ask them. These are applicable questions. Number one, which type of soil type, which of these soil type, could someone actually be and still be saved? If we believe in once saved, always saved, if we believe that we cannot lose our salvation, if you want a few memory verses for that on that, Ephesians 2 verse 8 and 9, John 3, 16, Romans 6, 23, they're quite good ones. You think about it, the hearers on the rocky ground, they received the word with joy. And how do we measure the growth? We've got a prop over here. That's your cue, Grace. What's that then?
Came from Israel and this wheat, or it might be barley. But this one's got about 60 seeds on it. If it's got less, it's not so good. But if it's got 100 seeds, that's a really good crop. And if the whole crop is producing 100, that's brilliant.
Okay, so that, did we say it was wheat? So we think it's wheat, and we think there are 60, do you call it buds?
Kernels.
So it's increasing 60-fold, and that's, as I say, is a fairly good one. There are better ones, there are worse ones. So, and that's fairly easy to measure, because you can count them. But how do we measure our spiritual growth? Is anybody here who's got a spiritual growth of 100 times? Okay. Anybody a bit rubbish and got 30? How do we measure that? Okay, that's the first question. I'll leave these up so we don't have to dive into all of them. Which soil type would we attribute to specific individuals we know of? I'm not necessarily thinking that bloke who sits at the back of the church each week who you're a bit non-sure about. But all the disciples fell away when trouble or persecution came. And by that definition, if you're taking this, as I say, literally, that definition, Peter and Judas fall in the same category. Arguably, so does Mary. And number three, moving away from a strict interpretation, can we apply this to different parts of our lives? Have we been different soil types at different stages of our life? Or different parts of our lives? Are we, for example, good soil when it comes to moral purity, but are we rocky ground in terms of God having access to our finances and a bit thorny ground in terms of our witness? Well, I'm going to leave it there because, as I say, I think there's some questions there which the passage explains but doesn't explain. So I'll leave it to you. It was a nice short one, wasn't it?
Well done, Chris. Let's give a round of applause at this stage.
I don't think we should let Chris entirely off the hook. So if we have got odd little questions, I think I'm sure Chris would have thoughts on it he spent some time on it. Does anyone want to comment?
I don't find the parable itself difficult to understand, but I don't understand why. I don't understand the part that says they may ever be seeing, never perceiving, ever hearing, but never understanding, then I can't understand why a parable would be given if people weren't meant to understand it.
I think this is one of the hardest verses in the Gospel. Yeah. Chris?
It's one of the hardest verses in the Gospel. Chris?
Your other mic's on, don't worry.
The other mic's over there. I've unclipped it. Yeah. Yeah, I might be touching or something like that and be picked up. Oh, I forgot the question was now. How did that come back? That was the picture I didn't want there.
Oh, I've been mic'd up again. I'm going to be in stereo now, aren't I?
I think it relates back to the passage in Isaiah, which is saying that God is revealing himself, but you've got to look for him. And I say that if you compare the passage in Mark with Isaiah, Jesus seems to emphasise the negative side of it more, that if you don't look, you won't find out.
It just reminds me of, I think we spoke about it previously, about the flowers on a mountainside that no one will ever see. It sort of reminds me of just God saying it just for himself, just for a joy. That's what came to my mind. But yeah.
And one thing that that I was thinking about today when I was thinking about this verse, or I read or came across somewhere, is, you know, that Pharaoh's heart is hardened. And God hardens Pharaoh's heart to perform a purpose, to bring about a greater good. And sometimes God hardens people's hearts to bring about his purposes. And it's quite tough. It's in the same kind of area as Chris was saying. Some people, we are chosen before the foundation of the world, and yet we choose Jesus, but of course God's chosen us. So we don't want to go too far down this, but Calvinists would say that only certain people are saved. And so it kind of goes like that. I mean, and Jesus is trying to hide his identity, isn't he, still? Yeah. So he doesn't want everyone to know straight away who he is. So maybe that's partly why he's speaking in parables. Gilbert, did you want to add something?
Always comes to mind in this chosen is that I remember as kids you had football teams. I choose you, but you have a possibility of saying no. I don't want to be on your team. I want to be on the other team. But the other one I was come back to was going right back to the first part, and that was his brothers and his mother. And it's quite easy for Mary to start out positively, but she's got the kids with her, and the kids are all negative. And we can have the same problem in that we start out positive, but our company draws us down. Mm. That's what it says. Keeping bad company is not a good thing.
It's also to do with God's foreknowledge. He knows, even though he's chosen us before the foundation, he's chosen us because he knows that we're going to be saved. I don't quite know how to describe it, but sort of a continuous circle, but he knows, so therefore he chooses us. But he didn't choose us so that we had to be saved. We still had to make the choice. We still have.
Do you want to ask anything more about that, Ruth?
No.
Did anyone want to respond to any of those questions up there? They're very good questions.
Oh, just one thing. The soil types, I don't think it means that. I think the person that produces 100% is to do a bit with works, really, in a way, and sort of making Jesus known, things of that sort.
So you're saying that rather than our spirituality, rather than our level of spirituality, fruitfulness, fruit of the Spirit, mm-hmm. Things to ponder there.
This verse, seeing they may see and not perceive, etc. I was talking to someone about this verse, not this last week, but the week before, and I got some revelation and inspiration from it, and I said to them, oh, that's the best I've understood that verse, but unfortunately, I can't remember it. But I'm going to try and pick up with them what it was they shared with me and hopefully share it with you another time, because it was enlightening and it was very positive.
Jesus was sitting in a boat, and the people were all out on the shore. And it's quite probable that there was a farmer just up on the hills just doing that. And the parable sort of went along with the picture, that they could actually see this happening. Mm. Where the seed was falling and things.
And one thing I was thinking about was just relating the different cases to different characters in the Gospel of Mark. So the first one, Satan comes immediately and takes away the word. I think it's interesting because Satan is the bird of the air, isn't he? And Satan, obviously, is very active in this regard. So when the Gospel's going out. But I guess, well, it's the Pharisees, isn't it? And it's the scribes who are not paying any attention to the miracles. And then the stony ground, receive it with gladness. Well, this is where it comes up, Chris, isn't it? You mentioned Peter and Judas, didn't you?
Well, Peter and Judas both initially accepted Jesus and fell away.
And then Peter came back.
Peter denied
thankfully.
Him.
Yes.
He also fell away.
Yeah, he did.
Peter denied him.
Yes.
Several times.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And the other one was the ones who hear the word, the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches. The rich young ruler is the kind of most obvious character in in Mark who wants to follow, but kind of it's just a bit too much. Yeah. And then hopefully we're amongst the good soil, as Chris said, along with the disciples eventually.
But can you be on stony ground and still be saved?
I would think not, because he said it did not bear root. And the analogy I had in mind was, you go to a crusade, you go forward, and before you've got away from it, all your friends have come along, say, you don't want to do anything. No, you don't. And you go with them. So I think the important part is it just says it didn't bear root. So it didn't bear root in that the word has got to bear root in our lives. And it's not just a word. It has to take root.
But if you've been saved at the crusade, if you believe at the crusade, once saved, always saved, regardless of how long you last,
yes,
are you saved?
Well, yes, because the word is taken root. But sometimes you can go up and say all the nice things because your friends have gone up, and you've gone and sat down. No, that didn't take root. The other one that was interesting, because I had a look at this out the fields next to me, and I counted up for the wheat. And of course, a single grain can produce a single stalk, but a single grain can produce multiple stalks, and that's why you get the various quantity.
I think verse 19, that we would all have to be careful that we weren't as fruitful as we otherwise might be. If we're always thinking, I'm not satisfied with my house, I want a bigger house. You know, and the desires of other things. Yeah. You know, we often have to train our thoughts not to be envious and to covet these ugly things. But those are the kind of things that cause us to be unfruitful.
It's to do with rewards. Obviously, the thief on the cross wouldn't have got any rewards, would he? But he still went to heaven, and we'll have some rewards when we stand.
Was he good soil then?
Was he?
Definitely.
He was. Yeah, the thief. But obviously, he won't get any rewards and get a crown to throw at Jesus' feet, because hopefully we will. When we get there, we'll know when we get there.
So I suppose, Chris, what you're asking, which is a good question about, you know, where it says in verse, you're playing devil's advocate.
Well, I think it's a really, on the face of it, it's a really simple passage.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to answer the obvious practical questions.
Which is just
curious.
Yeah.
Or am I?
But at the same time, I think there's some insight in this passage, isn't
there?
Oh,
absolutely.
Into how someone becomes saved, because it says, when they hear, verse 15, Satan comes immediately and takes away the word that was sown in their hearts. Yeah. So the thief on the cross, Satan didn't take the word away. No. It landed and it germinated and it sprouted and everything. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just my
wasn't one of the thieves actually saved? Because he said, I'm going to meet you in paradise.
Yeah, right.
Yes, and that's what Dad was saying, that he's obviously can't be stony ground because he's going to heaven.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
It was just, I was thinking about whether we have different times in our lives, and I think I would say that I do, where I'm not so fruitful and not as engaged with the Lord as I would like to be. And it's really just the Lord's grace that carries us through that, but it's something to reach out a bit against. We don't want to go into these times of quietness. Thank you. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Ross. Did anyone else have anything that they, a question they wanted to ask about this or?
I'm just thinking about the stony ground. with some young people, they get saved, and then with all the people, their peers all around them and everything, and theatre and holidays and stuff, and they just go away. But I believe that they are saved, mm-hmm. and that at the end, yeah. or near the end, they come back to the Lord. The Lord, he's able to bring them back again mm-hmm. when they've been through all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of responds to that last question, doesn't it, Grace? That some people, they're saved, but they're unfruitful for quite a long time, mm-hmm. and then maybe they might become fruitful later in their lives, I guess. That's what we'd hope for lots of our family and friends. And the only other thing that occurred to me, it was just a question, and I don't normally think like this. I don't think I'd have thought this if I was unpicking this or looking at this in detail. But this seems a little, you were saying about rewards, it seems a little bit like the parable of the talents. Hmm. In that you know, one guy goes off and buries it, doesn't do anything with it. Yeah. Someone else actually multiplies it. Another person multiplies it even more. Yeah. I just suddenly thought there's maybe a bit of a connection between the two parables.
It strikes me that possibly there are categories of people that we know that don't actually fit into any of these four groups. Mm. The people you're thinking of, Grace, they gave their heart when they were young. They fall away, but they're saved. But they've been totally unfruitful during their lives. But they gave their heart in the first place. I don't think they're covered in one of those groups. I think there might be other sets of people. Because he only just talks about four groups. Can we imagine more? That's just a thought.
Toby, it sounds like you're about to say something. Oh, expand on that point.
Oh, sorry, Bill. Oh, Lizzie first.
Yeah, I'm just interested in verse 11. To you it has been given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God. So that's got to be a key to this parable. I have to say, it's one for me, the parable of the sower has always been the most difficult parable for me to understand and remains so. But I think there must be some seeking that needs to be done, because to us it has been given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God. So a key to the kingdom, you know. Yeah.
It's nothing to say on it. That's how he's opening.
Sorry, that's how Jesus is opening up about the understanding of this this story, this parable. It's been given to them to know the mystery, and to us to know the mystery of the kingdom.
It does seem a very difficult one to be an early one, because it is that. I mean, you think of something like the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's got one central point which is fairly easy to grasp. That isn't. And this is supposed to be the basic one.
And what's interesting is that we don't get much teaching in Mark, and this is kind of the first bit of substantial teaching, you know, and it's so challenging to understand. Did you want to say something, Gilbert, still?
Come back to partly to what Roz was saying. Of course, this is only brings in fruit in season. It's not fruitful all the time, it's only fruitful at harvest. And we can all be like that. We can be fruitful at certain times, and the rest of the time we're just growing.
That's encouraging. That is encouraging. That is encouraging.
Thank you. I was just thinking about what Tony said earlier on about the rewards, and I was thinking about, because now is the season for planting, isn't it? And I've been planting different things, and I thought, I will be rewarded because I have treated the soil. And I think choosing our soil is very important, isn't it? I don't know in those days how much choice they had. It's a very, Israel in particular is a very dry country. But there are rewards to be had, I think, by planting in soil that has been prepared and that is ready, as it were. If I were to put the same things in year after year in my tubs, not put any new compost in or anything, I wouldn't get the show that I get. I get the reward by looking after the soil.
Yeah, and actually it's good soil, isn't it? That's almost the central question, is what is good soil? How do we be good soil? Yes, not kind of in terms of nitrates and all that stuff, but in terms of spiritually good soil. So if we're sowing the word for other people, how do we help them to be good soil as well? But I suppose we have to be good soil too, don't we? And other people kind of benefit from our goodness.
You said we hadn't had much teaching in Mark.
In Mark, yeah.
Yeah. But now we're getting the real solid stuff, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for some reason we've been given this really solid food, if you like.
Yeah.
Mm.
This is the good soil.
Yeah.
The Bible. The Bible is the good soil.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, it's kind of, I almost feel like we need another session at some point on the parable of the sower. We all need to go away and kind of look at it in more depth and come back perhaps with more thoughts. It feels like that. And Lizzie will remember by then what
I don't know. I'm struggling to remember where the conversation was. Don't hold your hopes too high.
Okay. Okay.
I hope to. I think I know who it was I was speaking to.
Well, let's close in prayer. And but it's really good. Thanks, Chris. I think I want to ask you to close in prayer. Is that all right?
Do you?
Chris, yeah.
All right.
Is that okay?
A delegation. Yeah, Father God, I thank you that all the things you've opened up today. I just pray that this would be something we meditate on. It is something that you want as fairly fundamental. I just pray that you'd apply those principles to our minds and to our hearts, Lord. Just pray that this will be something that we would work through in our lives, Lord, and that it would be your good soil. Amen. Mm-hmm.